Hello, today is the 4th of July 2005 and we are at the 14th floor of the DoubleTree Hotel, and this is Kevin of Theory is the Reason, and today I have a very interesting guest. His name was previously Acid Flask. Say hi.
Hello.
Okay, so it's interesting that we met in New York City. What are you doing here right now? What's your itinerary?
Right now I'm enjoying your couch. Your couch is very comfortable.
Okay. Yeah, the DoubleTree Hotel does have very nice amenities, I must say, for a 3-star hotel. What are you planning to do, say, tomorrow?
Alright, tomorrow I'm planning to visit a few more museums, probably the cloisters up in the very tip of Manhattan. Probably going to see a few more touristy things like the United Nations, Madison Square Garden, and hopefully trying to get tickets for Shakespeare in the Park, because it's been very, very difficult to get. Lots of people have been queuing up like mad for it. Probably not surprising because it's free, and
yeah.
I guess Singaporeans are not the only people who are kiasu enough to get free stuff, but anyway.
Yeah. Kiasuism is a universal thing. Do you think there'll be scalpers around for the kind of tickets? Or?
No, I really don't think so. When we went on Sunday, it was a lot of people, but I don't remember seeing anyone
selling the tickets.
Yeah. It was like really a lot of people, because they're like, the theater wasn't very big, and the line was like, you know, stretching around like don't know how many horizons of walkway.
I see.
It's quite scary.
Yeah, in New York, you gotta get pretty used to a lot of queues, especially for like things like the public restrooms. Is very rare around here. It's something that we really had to get used to.
Yeah, that's one thing. American cities apparently don't like to have toilets in their subway stations.
Anywhere for the matter. A lot of the shops and restaurants, they seem to, because they own the restroom, so they, you know, don't just let anyone in unless you're a customer. So it's really one of the things that kind of like enjoy back in Singapore, where, you know, it's so easy to find all these simple basic things in life, you know.
Yeah, well, I guess it's not as bad as in Europe, for example. Like, I went to Paris once, and like to go into like a McDonald's toilet, you had to have a receipt number punched into the door just to have it open. Yeah, and every ticket there's like a 4-digit number. It says like expires within like 1 hour or 2 hours or something like that.
Wow. So you can't hold on even to the ticket and come back the next day.
Yeah. So
quite a system they have there.
I guess my point is just it could be much worse.
Why do you think this is the case? What makes Singapore so different from all the other countries that you've visited so far?
I'm not sure if I've been to that many countries to comment.
At least more than me.
I'm not sure about that. Anyway.
Yeah, I guess it's just...
I guess McDonald's are more... for example, McDonald's, right? Mm-hmm. They're kind of more landmarks than they are, for example, here. Where, like, McDonald's is, like, literally at every corner, every intersection.
So it's the rarity of it that makes it something different.
I guess so. I guess McDonald's in Singapore is more iconic rather than ubiquitous as it is here.
Okay.
In the sense that, you know, McDonald's is just so much part of the landscape here that people don't notice it anymore.
Yeah.
Whereas in Singapore, it's still like, oh, let's go Max, or, you know, like...
They still address it by, like, the full name or something, yeah. Okay. Okay. Any other quirks that you realized so far studying and living in the US, like, that's very distinctly different from Singapore? I mean, we're talking about things that Singaporean students or any Singaporean who's coming to the US might be useful to know.
Well, I guess probably one of the main things for most people is getting used to the weather. Because, like, I guess people are used to it being really hot and humid outside.
Yeah.
And having pretty much the same weather all year round. I guess going to the US, unless you're going somewhere nice like California or Florida, things like, you know, getting used to walking in snow, learning how to walk on slush without tripping and falling, things like that.
Or even driving in snow. That's a different adventure also.
Yeah,
a lot of people underestimate like how difficult it is to drive through snow, and it can be very, very dangerous.
I had a friend in near by where he was driving up to Wisconsin and he skidded on a patch of ice. His whole car just went off into the median and toppled a few times.
Oh, so
it was quite scary.
Did he make it out okay?
Well, yeah, I was in the car, so I'm here now. So.
Oh, you were in the car too?
Yeah. So we weren't pretty badly off, just like a bit shaken from the whole thing. Not even a scratch.
Wow.
The car completely total.
That's a good car then. What car was that?
I don't remember. It was one of those racy sports cars. So,
okay.
Yeah.
That's impressive. Yeah, we have this thing called black ice, I believe. And I think that could be something, you know, especially it's ice that you can't see, but it's very slippery. I've seen news reports like showing how the police would be at this part of the highway and the cars would just veer and spin out of control and they're hopelessly standing there watching all the cars spinning. So yeah, it's pretty... Gotta be pretty careful during the cold season.
I can't imagine how much worse it is in Buffalo considering how much snow you guys get.
Yeah, I guess snow isn't as bad as ice, if you put it that way. Ice, people slip stuff.
Well,
snow
doesn't snow melt into ice after a few warm winter days? Or do you not get that in Buffalo?
We get ice, but I guess if it's more snow than ice, then snow is safer. You know what I mean? This covers everything and adds traction.
Mm.
Yeah.
I guess in Champagne, the main thing is that the weather is pretty cyclic in the sense that there's a very predictable pattern of cold day followed by increasingly warmer days until there's one day where it's unseasonably warm.
Oh.
And then there'll be some kind of precipitation and it'll break back down to the cold days.
Oh, sounds very much like Buffalo actually. It gets very haphazard. Sometimes it's super hot and then the next week it'll just drop down. It's crazy.
Yeah, so for example, like in summer right now,
yeah.
It hits something like, 95 or 96 over maybe like a 1 week period, and then it will rain and the next day will be like 75 degrees.
Oh wow.
So, and like winter is the same thing. It will start from zero and climb up to, let's say, 35, or there's a few freak times where it hits like 60 or 70 for one day.
Okay.
And then that night it will snow like that, and then all the snow will completely freeze over into ice, and that's where it gets different.
Oh, that is weird. That's very extreme. Yeah. You were telling me how the Chicago was as well, all the cornfields and everything not helping out in your district where you live?
As far as wind is concerned, Chicago is known as the windy city.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it meant literally, in the sense that Chicago is next to a big lake and there's a lot of lake effect wind and all that kind of stuff, which I have returned to my geography teacher. But I guess it also doesn't help that downtown Chicago is very built up. A lot of skyscrapers everywhere.
Yeah, so it's all like wind tunnels.
Yeah, it just serves to channel wind all over the place.
Mm.
And when the rest of Illinois is really, really, really flat. It doesn't. There aren't very many cities other than Chicago, and like most of the cities are like the small town kind of city.
Yeah.
At most, like Champaign is like 70,000 people, and it's like already like considered really big.
Oh.
In that particular part of Illinois,
discounting
Chicago, it's like most of the cities are like 100,000 or something. Very typical Midwestern kind of feat of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And so when you combine the lake effect and the wind channeling effect with the fact that the rest of Illinois, apart from the small cities, is pretty much all cornfield, it's basically
like a natural freeze gun or something that channels all the cold.
It's kind of like a frictionless area for wind to move through, and I guess the whole Midwest, especially the Ohio Valley area, they get a lot of hurricanes during spring.
Yeah. I guess anyone who's been through winter can safely say that you can have snow, you can rain, can have anything, but it's the wind that makes everything so much colder. Yeah. Oh, at this point, Penny is actually going to sleep. Penny, do you want to say hello and bye-bye?
Hello and good night.
Okay. So how's life back in school? Where are you studying right now?
Oh, I'm still new by Dina.
Okay.
So I guess I've been incredibly busy this summer with doing full-time research.
Everything. Okay. Anything interesting to share? Any discoveries or anything you're...
Not really. I've discovered how to fix computers, I guess. So I'm part of a theoretical chemistry research group, and one of my group chores, I guess, is to fix the computers when they are down. And you also you run some calculation on them,
yeah.
And after like 20 hours, one of them will mysteriously go offline or hang. I have to go to the computer room and go and kick it, or you know, hit reset or something. Most of the time, I'll go there and they'll say like, oh, segmentation for blah 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 blah. I'm like, okay, whatever, just restart the computer, forget about it.
Okay, and pray that it works.
Yeah. Well, the way the computers are configured is that when you restart them, like using a hard reset.
Mm-hmm.
They automatically reinstall themselves.
Oh.
I guess they've been very used to things going offline. So
sounds just like those self-healing computers.
You know, I guess kind of like hit-proof, right? You just go there, click reset, and then just let the computer do its thing.
Okay.
But no, you know, it's a short-term fix, but you know, for long-term issues, you know, what if any piece of the hardware dies, then it's more elaborate. Because you just let it do its thing, and then it'll crash again tomorrow, and then you go back and check again. You know, hit reset again, and then next day it's still dead. So you go like, okay, you know, two or three times in a row you realize, okay, I must be something more serious than just software crashing.
Okay. Is there anything more rewarding about your major that you're doing, that you're working on?
Hmm. Well, I guess it's interesting to see how you can do chemistry without actually any wet labs or wet chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
No, I guess I was quite clumsy, so I never developed a particular inclination to doing like hardcore synthetic chemistry or anything like that.
What's the main motivation for you taking up chemistry?
Mm.
Above, let's say, something like physics or anything else. Why chemistry?
Why chemistry?
You just like it?
I don't know. I guess it was a combination of having decent JC teachers in chemistry, plus the fact that I didn't mind the subject, at least not. You know, I liked it to the point where I could conceive myself actually pursuing a degree in it. Then, you know, going to U of I, of course, helped.
Mm.
In the sense that, you know, so it's a very nurturing environment. In the sense that there are like many, many, many opportunities out there, especially for art research. And it kind of just helps shape the tone of defining what you like and what you don't like.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's immensely helpful. To just, you know, just give it a try, and if it doesn't work, at least you know during undergrad days, and not like commit yourself for like 20 years into that career and say like wake up one day and say like, oh, I hate this.
Okay. Now at this point, right, depending on how comfortable you are, are you willing to share like how life was like as someone who was previously a bonded student? Versus right now, you're no longer bonded.
I guess that's not always an easy thing to answer. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's a generic answer to that question. But for me, you know, I guess it really boils down to the fact that as a bonded person, you're really not in control of your life anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You've pretty much signed away your freedom to choose for the next 10 years or so. From undergrad studies to whatever master's program or graduate program, and then subsequently your choice of work. And you know, if you are willing to come out with the money or find some form of financing on your own, like a student loan or something like that, then yeah, you're still pretty much in control of your life, and it gives you more room to explore what you want to do.
Mm.
And whereas, you know, if you take up a government scholarship or anything like that, I mean, the main caveat is that you have to work for them, and you know that from day one. So on some level, really, no basis for complaint if you don't like it, because that's just how the way the package comes.
Mm-hmm. And you were also telling me about how it's not just unique to Singapore to, for example, be bonded for 6 years, but also in several other countries.
Yeah, I've spoken to quite a few people who aren't Singaporeans. Apparently, this is quite common in, for example, Thailand, Vietnam, and even Saudi Arabia. So just of the few people I know personally,
mm-hmm.
in my program, they all have similar government-sponsored programs where they pay for studies and then you go back and work for them for like 6 years or 8 years, or even 10 years.
And it'd be interesting to know, right? Have you spoken to them in depth, like how they deal with how they come to the decision, first of all, of being bonded, and second of all, how does the their people or their, you know, how do they feel about people who sort of like end their bond or break their bond? Do they have the same kind of issues that Singaporeans face as well? Do they see the same things?
Well, I don't really know any of them to the point where I can actually say that I've discussed at length what it means to be a government scholar or anything like that, but definitely at some level, some people really need the government sponsorship just as an avenue for opportunity. Some people just will not have the means to do so otherwise.
Mm.
And like, in Singapore, I'm sure quite a few people take up government scholarships for that reason, but you can see how for example, like Thailand, if you're not born into a reasonably wealthy country, there's no way you could afford even the cheapest state school in the US.
Mm.
Right? It's just simply out of the question for the vast majority of Thai people.
Yeah, okay.
And as to whether there are any more pressing issues, I don't really know. I haven't talked to them at length about it. Mm-hmm. But I would definitely say that that is one of the main driving forces for applying for government scholarships and the like elsewhere as well.
Okay. So, there were two milestones that I can sort of see when it comes to making this kind of decisions to whether signing up for a bond and breaking up for a bond. I'm interested to know, like, what compelled you personally to take up the bond, knowing that, you know, it's not something that is an easy decision. And then second of all, after that, actually turning your life around and sort of, you know, saying, no, I've decided to end it here. You know, can you describe to me, like, how you came to the decision first on both instances? Was there any compelling reason? Or was it something that you, I'd say, had a hard time coming to terms with?
I guess with regard to applying for a government scholarship and getting bonded, I think really the whole motivation was that I felt at that point in time, or at least it was sold to me as such, that, you know, going up for a government scholarship gives people the opportunity to not just serve the country, but be in a position where you'll be actually in a role that will allow you to do something about things that you're not particularly happy about or things that can be improved upon.
So literally making a difference in Singapore?
Yeah, pretty much. Especially when it comes to public service.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess, you know, probably it was a combination of getting bitter and cynical over, you know, I mean, how much do I know when I'm 18, right? So mm-hmm. I think, now that I look back on it, I think, like, you know, 18 years old is really not a point in where you can decisively say, okay, I know this is what I want to do with my life, ABC, 1, 2, 3, and list them all up. I just don't see it happening for the vast majority of people. And, you know, as far as that was concerned, you know, that was the whole motivation for me signing up. But then, you know, perhaps an issue of conflict between what I see is really a way I can serve my country and the way other people think, who are in charge of me, think that I should serve the country. It's kind of obtuse when I put it that way.
But I think I see what you mean. I mean, different perceptions of how you serve the country.
The thing is that when you're a bonded government scholar, there's still a very strong top-down control approach to what you should do. And it's probably not surprising because at some level, when you come back, it's an entry-level job. And, you know, entry-level people aren't put in many positions where you actually get a say to say, like, okay, I want my department to be run this way or that way. But on the other hand, it's kind of strange that they apparently don't see a paradox in sending people overseas to say, okay, we're sending you to a country famous for XYZ, go and learn how they do it. And then come back, and when you tell them, okay, I think the way they do it is because of 1, 2, 3, ABC. And they go like, no, that's wrong, that can't be the reason. And like, you know, that's not how we do things in Singapore. And on some level, sure, there are some cultural issues which perhaps have to be worked out, like, you know, things like getting all politically active and going out to say, like, okay, I don't like the way this is being run. I'm going to write to my congressman, like, the way they do here. Or I'm going to petition my representative or whatever. It's not really the way Singaporeans think about politics. I think when people talk about, like, I'm going to see my MP, it's really because, like, there's some serious thing going on, like, oh, okay, you know, I really need, for example, an HDB apartment in this particular estate because my grandmother's there and she's sick, that kind of thing, and HDB won't let me have it, for example. I mean, just cooking up some random example here.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and I guess it's really a thing about trying to get the fruits of what other countries have without a more thorough idea, even conceptual framework for how to get the result.
Okay. Given that critique, right? If you had a say in how things should go, what would be the ideal? I mean, constructively criticizing this, how should we, you know, how do you think people should go about it then?
Well, I guess my personal ideology is very much libertarian, mm-hmm. in the sense that I think right now what the government needs to do is just simply be willing to let go and let society do what it wants to do. And you know, I think a lot of Singaporeans have a lot of interesting ideas as to what they want to do with their lives, how they want to contribute to society. But on the other hand, perhaps most people still feel pretty much straitjacketed into some kind of abstract, nebulous ideal that the government seems to have for its people. And like, oh, this is, you know, this is the ideal thing we want you to do. First it was computer engineering or something like that. And now it's entrepreneurship, life sciences. But, you know, I just don't see how you can shoehorn people into doing these things. Perhaps at some point when Singapore was less developed, mm-hmm. it made sense to say, okay, we need 5,000 doctors, 2,000 engineers, and 100 lawyers. Okay, go set the quotas for this number of people.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it made sense to catch up to the kind of economic development that we have now.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess now that on some level we have arrived in the sense that at least one long-term plan, I think it was like Singapore 1980, you know, the whole issue of like getting a Swiss standard living by 1980 or something like that. No, wait. Getting a Swiss standard living in 1980 by the year 2000.
Mm.
So I think as far as that is concerned, I think it went pretty successfully.
Okay.
So I guess it's really an issue of needing to shift mentality from we are a developing country playing catch up to now we are a developed country in our own right. Let's create our own national identity, pretty much,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
relative to some international scene.
Okay. I think to add on to what you've said, I went back to Singapore in June this year, and in December last year. And it's just early part of this year, January, and there was this thing called the Youth SG, I believe, which was held in Ngee Ann, and it's actually a youth conference, and the whole idea of having the youth conference was very much input from Ngee Ann students, but also endorsed, sort of like supported by the Ministry of Youth, Sports and Youth Development. And the main idea that they, you know, I could see for the first time, you know, face to face between teenagers, the youth that the government was targeting for, you know, our future generation and so on, and the government themselves and the media all coming to the same arena talking about issues. And the main thing that I seem to draw from this, what I call a confrontation, is the idea that the media and the government want the youth to be able to be the next generation of leaders who can make decisions on their own and be creative at you know, being entrepreneurial and all that. And they want to reinforce the idea that they shouldn't be afraid to say what they want to say, because they want to let to listen to the youths. What was ironic though was that each time someone took the mic from the audience to talk about issues, they would do what I seem to recognize as self-censorship. They would self-censor themselves. They seem to be developing a behavioral pattern where they would just stop themselves from saying certain things. Some of them would even go as far as say that, oh, I know that if I were to say this, this is not going to bar anyway. The newspaper or the media says that, you know, we'll publish what you say, but how much actually gets published anyway? Who's really going to listen? And, you know, you see this back and forth happening where the media say, no, just try. And the teenagers go say, no, it's useless. And then, you know, other people saying, you got to test the gray areas. So I see that happening back home, and it's kind of, it's very much ingrained to our Singapore culture. I don't know how you feel about this, but it seems to bear relevance to what you're saying here.
I guess perhaps one issue is really the question of whether there's sufficient separation of power in Singapore.
Mm-hmm.
I think in a real functioning policy, there's always an issue of checks and balances,
mm-hmm.
of having the judicial branches, executive and legislative branches, very clearly delineated. And I just don't see that in Singapore. So the upshot of that is, once you say something that's not in accordance with government policy, there's no telling what exactly could happen to you if certain so-and-so high up somewhere decided that, oh, I don't like this guy because he has a different political opinion, whether he's going to do something about it. I mean, we have things like the Internal Security Act, which is, you know, reputedly created to stop anti-communist insurgency in like the 1960s or 70s. But there's no telling whether or not such a law could be abused by perhaps some person in the legislature, for example. And if that happens, there's no real well-defined process, for example, a person in the judiciary, some supreme judge, to come down and say, like, this is what you're doing is wrong, and this is unconstitutional, you need to stop this. So I guess as far as that's concerned, really, the government just controls far too much, and to the point where you don't really know how much you can say before you end up in big trouble.
Yeah.
And, okay, you know, without this kind of clear delineation of what the government can or cannot do, citizens would just not be able to feel, at least, if not completely unrestrained, at least know what are the boundaries of what is acceptable and what is not.
Okay. So I guess for now, what would be the next best thing then for us to just test the boundaries? Do you think it's okay? Or do you think that even if we test it, we also get in trouble?
No, I'm not too keen on this idea of testing boundaries, simply because there seems to be a hidden assumption in this that the boundaries themselves will remain fixed in time.
Mm-hmm.
When in reality, it's not.
Never
at
existed.
All. Yeah, I guess not so much that the boundaries never existed, but the fact that the boundaries themselves are fluid. What was acceptable 10 years ago may not be acceptable now, or the converse.
Okay.
And, you know, it's just a fact of human society, I think. The fact that it's fluid and always changing. And to say, like, okay, you, for example, let's take everybody's favorite example of chewing gum, right? 20 years ago, you could chew chewing gum anywhere you wanted, forever, how much, you know, for like 50 cents a packet or something like that. Then 10 years ago, you couldn't. And then now 1 year ago, okay, maybe you can, but you need a prescription. Who knows what will happen 2 years from now? Maybe they'll invent some magic anti-gum dissolving solvent, and then suddenly it'll be okay for gum to be chewed again, simply because there's actually a cheap and efficient way of removing it.
Mm. So in a way, you're talking about efficiency being the idea of, if there is an efficient way of managing things or doing things in a certain way, then perhaps it's okay to do those things, and, well, something to that extent.
Well, I don't really know why the ban on chewing gum was instituted exactly, but it would stand to reason that the pragmatic underlying factor was behind it. Mm-hmm. In the sense that, I don't know, maybe somebody up there decided that Singapore's getting too messy, or the cost of chewing gum, of cleaning up after chewing gum was prohibitive. And, you know, on some level it is, because it takes a professional cleaning company thousands of dollars in special solvents just to get rid of one piece of chewing gum on one carpet.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you know, like 10,000 people decided to smear chewing gum on like an HDB flat lid, or just throw it on some random carpet, or even just, you know, some expensive marble tiling, so that's it. You know?
Yeah.
Millions of dollars in cleaning bills, even for the government, it's not a trivial thing. And, you know,
yeah,
especially with taxpayers' money, is it really worth it, for example,
yeah,
for taxpayers, for every taxpayer to be subsidizing the bad habits of a few gum chewers?
Yeah.
You know, I guess in Singapore, a decision was made that this was not the case.
Yeah.
That this was not economically or you know.
If there's anything, I think our government is very, very efficient. I think that's a trait that other countries are envious about.
Perhaps too much so.
Perhaps, yeah. Perhaps there's the pros and the cons of being efficient then, which is interesting to study. Yeah.
Well, I think my main gripe is that somehow the government treats Singaporeans as just some statistic. You feel like a statistic, or just a number, or some resource. Not so much being a human, you know,
okay,
a person with you know, unique circumstances, unique feelings, unique decisions, but they kind of treat you more interchangeably, like, oh, we need X number of these kind of people, okay, we'll just go recruit them. It's almost, you have this feel that almost like being in a SimCity simulation.
Oh, okay.
Like, you know, oh, today the population is 4,251,101, okay. Oh, today there are 5 more people, okay, maybe they immigrated from the neighboring country in SimCity, like, or something.
Okay.
Or like, oh, suddenly this apartment block just showed up. I guess, okay, maybe that didn't quite make sense, but I guess the main point is that
there's a very clinical approach to things, which,
yeah,
which you're trying to say here.
Whereas I think people in America tend to be much more humanistic, in the sense,
yeah,
that, you know, by default you assume to be a person with unique cultural background, for example, unique upbringing, unique decisions about your career, and people value you for your differences as much as they value you for your skills or whatnot. Whereas in Singapore, there's a very strong bias against having anything unique about yourself.
Okay.
You know, in the sense that, you know, people tell you, don't try to be too different, just do whatever so-and-so tells you to do, don't try to make trouble, that kind of thing. But, you know, it's just not the way people think here. People here are all about, okay, this is what I want to do with my life, and, you know, if it serves your purposes, then hire me, if not, don't.
So in a way, it's like the people actually give more choice then. It's sort of like a natural selection. By being different, there's a natural selection order, you know. And with a wider natural selection out there, it's like, I think, you know, it's sort of like you have more possibilities, more things that could be accomplished than just having everybody sort of like streamlined into certain areas. Just like, sounds like elders, like 1984, that kind of thing. Like, you are this, you are this, you are this.
Yeah. Well, I guess 1984 in a way is like, it's trying to be science fiction, but then of course science, and somehow it's this way of running itself ahead of fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what George Orwell, was it George Orwell? No, sorry. Aldous Huxley.
I think so.
Yeah, okay. What Aldous Huxley envisioned in 1984. I guess by today's standard, it's just laughable, in the sense that, you know, they're already having enough trouble cloning, like, a sheep. Okay, until very recently, I guess. Now that with recent breakthroughs in South Korea and all that, you know, without getting too technical, I guess. The point being is that today it's already really difficult to even clone, like, maybe the skin tissue of some person, let alone, you know, having a particular embryo that can be split off into like 17,000 other siblings or, you know, identical clone children. And that was supposed to be 1984. This is like, you know, 2005, and people are still having trouble, right? So on some level, science fiction expects too much. And on some level, it doesn't expect enough. Like, Aldous Huxley definitely did not envision ubiquitous computing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wrote the book in an era where people said, like, okay, there's a world market for 5 computers, for example. And I guess we know now that the world has use for quite a few more than just 5 computers.
Okay.
Okay, but that's completely missing the point.
That's fine, it's an interesting conversation.
I guess with regard to social issues, I guess the real thing here is that perhaps this kind of organization, this kind of society, is very good if you have an overarching vision and a very clear, well-defined goal that you want to attain for the entire society. And, you know, being a very centralized government definitely brings you a long way in terms of efficiency and effectiveness in getting there. But the way I see it now is that we've kind of arrived on some level, in some sense, we've arrived on the scene. We are, for all practical purposes, a developed country. So now the question is really, now what? Now that we are a developed country, now that we are economically viable, now what? We can't still fall back on the days where, like, all you had to do to increase competitiveness is just drop wages. I mean, how can you have world-class talent when you're not willing to pay world-class wages for them? No, it just won't happen. But I guess that's really an issue of imbalance in Singapore society for the past few years. The fact that you tout yourself as having world-class engineers and doctors and whatnot, but on some level, you're not willing to pay world-class prices for them.
Mm-hmm.
You definitely don't pay an engineer in Singapore anywhere close to what you would pay a similar engineer in, right here in New York, for example.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, part of it, I'm sure, could be explained by cost of living. But on the other hand, there is simply a raw element of people here valuing technical skills,
mm-hmm.
or at least valuing them in a financial sense more highly than Singapore.
Mm-hmm. Mm. If taken from an economic standpoint, that seems to make sense. Looking at it from the awareness and intellectual level, I think, in a sense, you've heard this term very commonly, you know, term that's like, feeding from a silver spoon or something. We are very used to being spoon-fed to the point where sometimes we don't take care of ourselves. And I think the problem here is the government's trying to instill self-awareness, the ability to think for yourself, but yet at the same time we're so used to being, you know, taken care of that we have this inability to think already. So there's a problem here in that even as I see as even as people start to be able to think for themselves, they are holding themselves back because they are very used to the way the system works. So perhaps, I think my take on the issue is, yeah, perhaps there's an economic issue that's holding all this back, but there's also a very much the intellectual issue whereby who's really doing the thinking here and how can the government actually, is the government willing to take the risk to let the people think for themselves? I think that's also an issue to be considered. Yeah.
Perhaps even more fundamental to that, I don't think there's a society in this world that quite knows how to solve the problem that Singapore is facing right now.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense of, how does one transit gracefully from being a developing country to a developed country?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, countries like the United Kingdom had centuries to industrialize and modernize. And, you know, people like us playing catch up had to do it in a few decades or otherwise face obsolescence forever.
Mm-hmm.
And on one hand, you know what you want to do when you're starting up with nothing. You want to modernize, industrialize, attract capital, build the economy, blah 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 blah. So now the question is, okay, we've done it all in one generation or so. How do we actually transit gracefully to another generation living in a mindset that is suitable for a developed country? And is there a way to do it without some socially devastating...
Usually that's the case, yeah. Usually it takes some
major revolution to occur before we can move on to the
it's
next.
It's kind of sad, but I guess yeah. very human in the sense that it takes a great tragedy to occur before you value what you have and don't have.
Yeah.
Like war, for example.
Yeah.
Sometimes what a country needs is just, irreversible loss of something for it to be kicked into some kind of rejuvenation, revitalization.
Yeah.
And, that's certainly one way to get Singapore up and coming again, but is it really worth the cost? And
yeah. Is there a safer alternative?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, democracy was an attempt at a solution of peaceful balance, transfer of power. So I guess what we really need now is a similar kind of invention in sociology. Is there some kind of doctrine or some kind of procedure for transiting from a peacetime developing country to a peacetime developed society without, without having to do it in 5 or 6 generations? Is it possible to actually do it within one generation? In Singapore, we have this feeling that we've rushed so hard to get to where we are today that we've kind of left a lot of things behind.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the things that we lose, we're only just beginning to appreciate how valuable they are. I mean, things like speaking Chinese dialects and homogenizing everyone to the point where, a Chinese is a Chinese, a Malay is a Malay, an Indian is an Indian, and another is another. It's like, there's this whole idea, again, it's kind of straight-jacketing in the sense that Singapore has 4 races, and we always wonder, do you know anyone who is considered other race,
Yeah.
Who is the other race or Eurasian? Even as Chinese, there actually is quite subtle but important differences between Hakka and Teochew and Cantonese and Hokkien. And even, it's even more acute for Indians, right? I mean, Indians are they're Tamil Indians and they're North Hindi Indians, and there are hundreds of Indian languages, and yet we kind of blithely assume that all of them speak Tamil or something like that. It's kind of in our default mindset. When you say Indian, you say, okay, this guy speaks Tamil with all those squiggly lines and whatever. And, of course, the catch-all other is just ridiculous, right? And I don't know much about Malay culture, but I would presume there's some difference between Malaysian Malay, Indonesian Malay, for example. In terms of linguistic structure, it's different.
Mm-hmm.
I assume societally, culturally, there's some of it as well. Perhaps even within various states in Malaysia that I'm not aware of.
Okay. So if we were to some way be able to recognize these differences, it might help to stimulate something here?
Yeah, well, at least going back to the whole America versus Singapore thing, there's a very strong trend in America of accepting other people's differences for what they are. Whereas in Singapore, the emphasis is much more on homogenizing the culture so that everybody feels like they belong to one monolithic culture.
Mm.
And, on some level, to be frank, I don't think it's been very successful simply because I guess nobody really knows how to engineer a culture, even if one knows how to engineer a society.
Mm-hmm. I think if anything, right, if let's say we were to not say that one culture or one nation is right or wrong, that it's rather interesting that we actually get to appreciate the differences in that, not just in people alone, the differences in the different kind of races of people, but in the way each country is run. I mean, if Singapore never existed, we'd never know how this kind of system would have worked. We'd never recognize whether the American system is the way to go or the Singapore system is the way to go. I think what I'm trying to say here is that if you look at the whole world as a canvas, right, or art gallery, you get to see each painting and they all come out differently. I think in the end, right, it actually boils down to a choice. I mean, I think that's boiled down to a choice, but it boils down to that kind of choice that a person can make. And if you can make that kind of choice, you get to choose where you want to live, and so on and so forth.
I guess that's one. That's probably a very important point, in that one needs to step outside a system to appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that, at least for me, I felt that going abroad to study really helped me figure out who I am as a Singaporean. What does it mean to be Singaporean?
Indeed, yeah.
You know, even if it's something as trivial as waking up one day and going like, I want char kway teow, please, I'm sick and tired of American food. Or, you know, something more subtle like missing family and friends, or like, you know, like just missing my Joe hangout at the Orchard Library or something like that.
The more sentimental things.
So, which is like, you know, the kind of thing which I guess social planners would rather abstract away and pretend that everyone likes Zouk, or everyone likes to go watch fancy concerts at the Esplanade or something, you know.
Right.
When it's obviously not true. I
mean, it's 1 o'clock.
Wow. Yeah.
Is it going to get recorded? 1 o'clock.
It might.
Oh, well.
It is 1 a.m. But yeah, so I agree that some things can be engineered. Some things are just spontaneous, in a sense. Like, you know, whether you like a certain spot in Singapore, you miss a certain food, it could be in the dingiest spots, but it just makes, it's just home to you in a certain sense. It's very familiar, nostalgic to you. And because certain things can be engineered, everyone's so different. By appreciating the differences, by creating the differences, only then, perhaps, for example, you could not only stimulate the interest for people to, like, stay in Singapore, to go back to Singapore, keep thinking about Singapore, but also to work hard in the different regards for Singapore, you know?
No, isn't this a very classically philosophical question?
Mm-hmm.
In the sense of, like, you know, if there's no one in the forest and the tree falls in it, it doesn't make a sound. You know, how do you know what sound is until you have actually experienced the sound. Okay, maybe that wasn't quite clear, but the point was,
you gotta know the difference to see the difference. You get to step outside the box.
Basically what it boils down to is in order to step out of the box, you have to know what the box is.
Mm.
And
it's kind of like a matrix from the sound of it.
Yeah, it does sound kind of matrixy, but definitely you can't think outside the box without knowing what the box is.
Mm. Yeah, otherwise you don't know where to step out of.
I guess the paradox of that is that if you know what the box is, can you really step outside of it?
Mm.
Because you will forever know that the box exists. Okay, I guess that was really way too chim, but
that would take a whole semester.
That's what philosophy people get paid to do.
Philosophize.
Yeah. I guess it's still really an issue of, you know, we as Singaporeans, despite years of effort, I guess, still really don't have an issue of intuitive sense for what is national identity. I mean, yes, okay.
Yes, don't you find it ironic that although you don't have a sense of national identity, I take it that you do still miss home?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's not often I get to let my hair down and just not think about speaking in an Americanized way.
Yeah.
You know, it's been something as simple as that, or like food. You know, I guess it's kind of like the main thing. Like, when Royston Tan was in University of Chicago, he showed his some of his short films, and there was one about a coffee shop in Singapore, and there were scenes like, you know, of making, was it mee pok and char kway teow, and then basically when they were showing the cut scenes, everyone's going like, oh, I'm so hungry, I want to eat it, oh, that kind of thing. And it's, you know, and even Royston himself was kind of amused by the whole effect. He was saying like, you know, when he showed it in Singapore, it was just like, oh, okay, you know, it's just, you know, documentary of our lives. Whereas, like, for us overseas students who are like, you know, we have been literally months at a go when you want to have char kway teow.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, the reaction is just so much more intense, so much stronger just because we are deprived of it.
Yeah, yeah. But it's an interesting experiment, yeah.
It's also human, I guess. Just don't appreciate what you have until it's gone.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. And I guess I know someone who was desperate enough that he asked his parents to airmail him like a packet of char kway teow. It actually arrived in a condition that was still edible after microwaving, which was very impressive.
Wow.
So my only issue is just how on earth did they make it through customs, you know? Or did they just assume that just because it's DHL or FedEx, and they just like, okay, not very important, just let it go, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that is impressive.
Like, you know, what kind of, like, envelopes, like, it'd be kind of fishy, like, you think about it.
Okay.
Whatever.
Can't imagine. Yeah. Well, to end off nicely, how's life been ever since after the whole fiasco and all that in the media and all that? How's your life right now? How's your everyday life right now?
My everyday life, I guess I'm sufficiently busy that I can afford not to think about it most of the time. But I guess it's a experience, you know. We all do what we have to do, and, you know, if it comes to this kind of inevitable disagreement, then just have to live with it. Just work around it if necessary, and just remember that it's something definitely to keep in mind if you want to do it again.
Mm.
And if and when you want to do it again, rather, I should say.
Okay.
So, I guess it's...
Any last words?
Any last words? That really sound like more good.
I'm sorry, after this I have to take you somewhere and finish you off. I'm just joking.
Oh gosh, okay, maybe I should call NYPD now.
But any words of advice for anybody out there, for, let's say, bloggers, take your pick, I mean, whoever, whatever.
About what?
About what? That's a good question. I guess to always ask questions is a good question, is a good way to go. To always be curious.
Yeah, I guess so. Perhaps at the expense of being corny, almost, I would say, just don't afraid to be who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes to know who we are, you have to put yourself in an uncomfortable situation. That's kind of like the whole point of studying abroad.
Mm-hmm.
The whole point of going through things like OPS, NS, you know, things that you may not particularly enjoy, but you know, you learn, you grow by learning through these kind of things, what you can do and what you cannot do.
It defines you. Yeah.
Pretty much. So I guess, you know, it's kind of like the artist's issue, or maybe the sculptor's issue in particular, about a sculpture and the space around it.
Mm-hmm.
Because just as a sculpture is a sculpture, it's just a thing made of metal or wood or whatever, it's also a space in which the sculpture is embedded in. You know, in the sense that the space around the sculpture is not the same as just regular space with nothing in it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, you could make it mathematically rigorous, but there's no real point in doing that. It's just simply that just by existing, you will change your environment.
Yes.
And not only that, your environment, it defines who you are, and sometimes you don't know it until you learn more about your own environment.
Very interesting. Alright. I guess it's getting late now, you better hop on the train and head home back. Thanks for spending so much time with me.
Oh no, no problem. It's,
yeah.
It's fun to, I guess, meet someone.
Yeah.
In real life.
In the flesh. Yeah. And I must say, you're the first real, first actual Singapore blogger I've actually met ever since I started blogging.
I feel quite honored now.
I've been very secluded in Buffalo, and I don't know how you are in Chicago, but yeah.
Well, I guess in your vibe, quite one or two. I think it's starting to catch on.
Yeah.
And I guess catch on in the sense that people are actually starting to blog about things which are not entirely 100% stuff, like today I ate this, I went to watch this movie,
totally,
my friend,
yeah.
It's very good, yeah, it's okay, we almost going to watch. This kind of thing. I guess what Steve would say is infantile, progressing slowly beyond that.
Okay.
But I guess it's an issue of, you know, developing and finding your voice in the midst of all the stuff that people want to say. And somehow make it not sound like you just want to complain about everything.
Well, let's hope that people out there take this candidly and take it well. And I'm sure they will, and take it constructively. And I think I must say, if anything, Singapore's experienced an incredible growth in terms of blogging, and I'm sure it will soon develop its own, if not already develop its own voice in the entire blogosphere globally. With that, I guess we just sign off here.
Alright.
Okay, cool. Thanks for listening, whoever out there.
Well, thanks for inviting me out here to have a nice long chat about Singapore.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, that's it. Bye-bye.
Cool.